You're listening to the Charlottesville Podcasting Network at sevillepodcast.com. Lectures, radio shows, and more are available on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Now available through email. Sign up in our right-hand margin. I'm Dan Daniels. Bob Gibson is Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. He is a 1972 graduate of the University of Virginia with a BA in Government and Foreign Affairs. After serving as news director of WCHV Radio, he joined the Daily Progress in August 1976 and has held a number of positions with the newspaper. He began his career covering police and local court hearings and has covered state and local politics and government. He was named city editor in 1982 and later special projects editor in 1992 when he wrote a series about racial disparities and justice in the local courts. In addition to his newspaper work, Bob has hosted a weekly political call-in show on WINA Radio in Charlottesville for 7 years. He has also hosted a public radio talk show since 2001 on WVTF-FM in Roanoke and Charlottesville. He has been a regular contributor and guest on public radio station WAMU's Virginia Politics Hour in Washington. Bob is the winner of several Virginia Press Association Awards, the 1993 Virginia Bar Association Award in the field of law and justice, and the 1993 Southern Journalism Award for investigative reporting. Our podcast is entitled The Changing Face of Virginia Politics. Following his presentation, Mr. Gibson answered questions from the audience. Today's program was moderated by SSV President Marvin Hilton.
I'd like to introduce our speaker today, Bob Gibson. I've known Bob for a few years now, and the interesting thing about Bob is I used to work in the General Assembly during the legislative session for a few years, and I would go down the first 4 years, I think, I worked as a committee clerk, and then later on I worked as an aide for a Democrat 1 year and a Republican the next year, so you can see that I try to be independent. And the interesting thing is, and my wife used to question me on this, I said, why do you come home and read all the past papers, newspapers, the Daily Progress, when you were down there all week? Because I didn't come home during the week. And I said, well, because I don't know what's going on until I read Bob Gibson's column. Bob is presently the executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia. Prior to assuming that position, he was the political writer at the Charlottesville Daily Progress, which you can gather from what I've already said about Bob. He did that for about 30 years. He covered the local and state political antics and government. He also served as a city editor and covered police and courts in addition to that. Bob has received several Virginia Press Association awards. He's received the 1993 Virginia Bar Association Award in the field of law and justice, and the 1993 Southern Journalism Award for investigative reporting. He is also known to many Virginians as a host of the WVTF Public Radio's Evening Edition program. So, Bob, welcome. We're glad to have you with us.
Thank you, Marvin. Thank you very much. Can everyone hear me okay? I'm delighted to be here. It's a privilege to talk to an audience that knows something and cares something about politics and government, because that's not always true. Does anyone here know the difference between a state senator and a reporter? The answer is, because there's no ensuing election, the state senator knows that next year he or she has a job. But we'll talk more about that later. Virginia's political traditions are changing faster than they ever have, and faster than the late Senator Harry F. Byrd Sr. could have imagined or even tolerated. Senator Byrd and former Governor Byrd ran a state political organization from the late 1920s into the mid-1960s. And he had a great say from the courthouse to who went to Washington in who was elected to what office, including many local offices across the Commonwealth of Virginia. The Old Dominion, once pregnant with presidents, has been barren since Woodrow Wilson left a few ticks before the Civil War. It has now its first Roman Catholic governor in Tim Kaine, who was elected nearly 4 years ago. Now, three of the four men trying to succeed Governor Tim Kaine are Roman Catholic, leaving only Cree Deeds, a Presbyterian like Wilson, the only non-Catholic in the contest. What's the big deal, a young Virginia voter might say? Not that much. Religion doesn't matter as much these days. That is a bit of a change, as you all know. Religion still matters to many voters, but not the way it did several decades ago, when Catholics and many other minorities in Virginia could count more ways that they were excluded from political and social circles than the ways they were included. Virginia every year now resembles more and more a mid-Atlantic state than a traditional southern state. The political center of the state has changed. It has moved north and it has moved east with population shifts that have added relatively more voters to Northern Virginia and urban Tidewater. While Buckingham County, just to our south, the county south of Albemarle at Scottsville, remains the geographic center of Virginia, Fredericksburg is now more the population center. The issues of the Old South, appealing to racial, ethnic, and religious prejudices, sound foreign and contrived to increasing majorities of Virginians today. The heavy suburbanization of Virginia has left Fairfax County and every locality touching Fairfax the political colossus of the state, while vast portions of Virginia more and more resemble Lord Fairfax. Voting patterns also begin to mimic Fairfax somewhat. While more and more non-native Virginians are seeking and accepting meaningful community leadership posts across the state, half of Virginians today were born outside the state. Let me repeat that. Half of all residents of Virginia today were born outside of Virginia. Many in states to our north, Maryland, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, New York, New England states among them. They often bring their partisan predispositions with them when they move from one region to Virginia. One in 10 Virginians today was born in another country. One in 10. A fivefold increase in our foreign-born population since the 1970 census, when 2% of Virginians were born overseas or in another country. It's also interesting where these foreign-born Virginians are coming from. If you read the news, you would assume that many of them are from Latin America. Well, that's true, but the largest cohort of new Virginians born overseas are from Asia, from the Middle East, from South Asia, India, Pakistan, and from the giants Korea, China, Japan, Vietnam. 13% of foreign-born Virginians were born in Europe. That's way down from previous decades. 9% of foreign-born Virginians were born in Africa. The trend is especially strong in Northern Virginia and in Charlottesville, where the University of Virginia accepts thousands of out-of-state students, and many Asians and Latin Americans, Hispanic students from around the country and across the world, many of whom stay on in Virginia after they graduate from UVA. In fact, people haven't really recognized how large a cohort of our population that is. The Fredericksburg Freelance Star reported last week that UVA surveyed its class of 2003. Now, UVA every year now takes 31% of its students from out of state because they pay significantly more of the tuition than in-state students. 31% from out of state. After 5 years, the class of 2003, 14% of those in that class who earned a baccalaureate degree were still living in Virginia 5 years after graduation. 20% of that class who earned higher degree than baccalaureate degree master's or PhD. We're still living in Virginia 5 years after graduating from the university. A full 20% of graduate degree non-Virginians. These new Virginians are moving into the state and accelerating the state's trend away from being a southern state and from being a southern conservative state to being a two-party competitive state. These new Virginians, now half of the voting population, are not anti-immigration, as you might imagine. They're not as reliably anti-union as the state's political makeup had been. Having 3 out of 4 Catholic candidates for governor means little to them, just the same as having 3 out of 4 candidates for governor, the same 3 who happen to be born outside Virginia. Again, Cree Deeds, the Presbyterian, is the only native Virginian. One sure sign that Harry Byrd would be lost in today's Virginia is the current governor's legislative victory, which he signed into law yesterday at a restaurant in Virginia Beach. Banning smoking in Virginia restaurants after December 1st, unless those restaurants have a fully separated by door and fully air-conditioned, i.e. ventilated, separate nature from the rest of the restaurant. Virginia, a former tobacco and agricultural state, is no longer. It's now one of the nation's 10 wealthiest states. While a service and information age economy has replaced agriculture as our means of living. Not our tax structure, not the way we tax people, just the way we make money. Virginians are a much more diverse lot than they were 20 years ago, much more willing to elect leaders who are willing to work together across party lines. Virginians appear to be more willing to see government do what works, what's practical, regardless of ideology. Now, there are exceptions. They tend to be the older members of the General Assembly. Younger members of the General Assembly aren't as quick to retreat into hard partisan camps. Here are 10 simple non-ideological rules for people interested in public service. Number 1, look for the good in people. It's out there. It's our job to find it. Number 2, agree with people when you can and agree to work with people. 3, tell people when they make a good point. 4, respect people. Everyone wants respect, and everyone deserves respect, even if you can't think of how they may have earned it. 5, listen to people sincerely. 6, give people the benefit of the doubt. 7, leave your prejudices at the door, or at least be aware of how they limit you. 8, take yourself less seriously. The sun and the moon do not revolve around you. 9, read and listen before speaking. Remember, God gave us 2 ears and only 1 mouth. And 10, insert a positive thought into any negative situation. By the way, I wrote a somewhat insouciant, I used to be a reporter. I wrote a somewhat insouciant top 10 list of solutions for growth in the Charlottesville area 7 years ago. No one listened. We're still growing. This may be why no one listened. I have the 10. I just ran into this yesterday and I thought, maybe these still apply. Solution number 10, set a higher income floor and take the county, this is Albemarle, private. Membership has its privileges. And double membership means you can live behind gates. Solution number 9, stay public and get Richmond to set a no-growth budget far into the future. Anyone who mentions taxes is subject to banishment to Northern Virginia or Massachusetts. So what if that one's been tried? Try it again. Solution number 8, forget the no-growth, slow-growth, Boulder plan and go whole beaver into the Oregon mode. No more people are welcome here because no matter what you've heard, it's too bad, too dull, too yuppie, too hippie, a bad place to raise kids. No good music has been heard here since Dave Matthews left, and it rains frogs if it rains at all. Solution number 7, declare the University of Virginia the enemy. Remember, I wrote this 7 years ago. I was not employed there. Set no growth budgets far into the future, and yet let UVA choke on its own traffic. Promise UVA easy access to a fictitious US 29 Western bypass that stays on 5-year plans so long the university sinks all its money into 12-story serpentine brick parking garages. Solution number 6, fire local government promoters and public relations specialists and hire libelists. Tell the world that Charlottesville is merely a tiny version of Charlotte without the Hornets. Albemarle cuisine runs from moonshine hollows to hump burgers, and UVA decided long ago to take itself private, but the merger with Enron fizzled. Besides, not even a Mac McDonald or a Cappuccino High could reel off the David A. Harrison III field inside Scott Stadium, enveloped by the Carl W. Smith Athletic Center, surrounded by the Enron Darden competitive zone for creativity, accountancy, acquisition, energy, and ethics. I dare anyone to try that on the radio. Solution number 5, expand the death penalty and allow religious fundamentalists to enumerate all moral capital offenses. Even Sodom and Gomorrah would suddenly shrink to SoGo. Solution number 4, require all Albemarle residents to attend Foxfield races once a year or twice a year, drink a little too much, and then bet on the horses that they haven't seen. Stipulate that losers leave town. Solution number 3, create a system of conservation easements and adopt-a-farm donations under which organic farming, community-supported agriculture, and open space are encouraged to fill in and preserve all the green spaces between Albemarle's developed areas. The county would at least eat well and avoid Fairfax County population density while preserving a little honest agriculture. Horse farms would be encouraged to breed enough steeplechase entries to preserve the vitality of solution number 4. Solution number 2, this takes money so it will not fly, but rebuild Interstate 64 from Richmond to Lynchburg. They wanted it after all. And solution number 1, discover West Virginia by God and move there. Not one of those was adopted. The state of our media today ranges somewhere between despair and disrepair. Newspapers are folding. They're cutting back their coverage. This was most notable during the 2009 session of the Virginia General Assembly that just concluded. Newspapers that had two reporters there had one reporter there. Newspapers that had in the last 2 or 3 years one reporter there had no reporters there. The only television station in the entire Commonwealth of Virginia that regularly covers the Virginia General Assembly, Channel 29, Charlottesville. They deserve congratulations for that. Public TV and radio budgets were slashed, not as much as the House of Delegates would have liked, but more than the Virginia Senate and the governor proposed. At my paper, at the Richmond Times-Dispatch, at the papers in Lynchburg and Danville, reporters and editors all learned a few weeks ago that they are all expected to take 10 days off without pay between now and the end of September. This is something that isn't covered in the daily jobless statistics. The jobless rate's up to about 8% nationwide. If you incurred, if you counted the people who have had their hours and pay cut back, it would be well over 14%. In 1968, the average soundbite on the nightly news was 43 seconds long. You can say something in 43 seconds. The average soundbite on most of the media today is 5 to 6 seconds long, down from 3 times longer just 3 decades earlier. Leadership is not an easy thing to define. It means different things to different people. Perhaps leadership is when people want to listen to someone for more than 6 seconds. Americans' attention spans are short enough that people may soon forget how long our nation has been in a recession. Some words and concepts are harder to define than others. Last week, I was driving my 17-year-old daughter around Charlottesville. I was taking her to school at Charlottesville High School. And Stella turned to me and said, "Dad, you're a dork." And I said, "What does that mean?" And she sat there for a minute and said, "No, Dad, you're a nerd." And I said, "Well, what does that mean today?" She said, "I don't know, but it's 10 times worse than being a dork." You know, leadership is a wonderful quality that people in this room have displayed, and I see many friendly faces in this audience. I work with political leaders and covered them for 3 decades as a reporter. They're fun people, they're creative people. People like them. People like to be around them. It's true that the political candidate who is perceived as more electable is usually the political candidate you would rather have a backyard barbecue talk with than the one you're forced to listen to. Leadership is not affability, but affability helps. Leadership is not about comfort. It's not about money. It's not about making lots of money. Political leaders are not, of course, the only leaders, even necessarily the most important leaders. Community leaders, those who are political and those who are sometimes not, are the true leaders in my book. What do people look up to and want to follow or emulate in their community? They want to follow those people who they define as community leaders. Leadership is about being an example, living an example, being seen as exemplary. Leadership is really about service. Service to others, service to community, service to the state, the nation, service to some good cause other than one's own self-interest. So what qualities do people see in a leader? Philanthropy, yes. Inspiration, yes. The ability to point himself or herself in a direction and have other people follow. The ability to serve. The Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership at the University of Virginia is a fun and exciting place, because we work with such people across the state of Virginia. The most satisfying and exciting parts of my job are interacting with young leaders. We have a high school leaders program. We'll be bringing 30 high school leaders from across the Commonwealth the end of May to Charlottesville. They'll live in a UVA dorm for a month. They will learn, they'll have, in effect, a graduate-level course in politics and public policy. High school leaders from across the state will come for 2 weeks in July. We have a 10-month program for political leaders from their mid-20s into their mid-60s, and that's not limiting or defining, that's just the way they are this year, that began last weekend in Williamsburg. We spent 3 days in the old colonial capital, and it was a delightful 3 days because we have never had as many political leaders from as diverse a set of backgrounds. We've never had as many political leaders from west of the Blue Ridge in Virginia. In fact, on March 26th, I'm going down to Roanoke with some staff members to interview 20 high school and college students who are trying to get into our summer programs at the University of Virginia, 20 students from Southwest Virginia. We've never had more than 2. There is a rebirth in our state right now of people who are optimistic about political leadership. We have a college leaders program every summer. The 60 or more students who participate in it and its high school program give me the most hope for the future of politics in Virginia. They're ethical, they're civil in their tone, their conversation, their demeanor. They believe in the power of bipartisan discussion and in decisions that are made with everyone having a voice at the table about public policy. They know there's a time for partisanship in politics. Politics is partisan. They know it isn't all the time. Most of what the government does is not partisan, doesn't have to be, shouldn't be overly partisan, is only hindered and cheapened by super partisanship. Younger leaders seem to get this more often than their elders, and that's true in the General Assembly. The Sorensen Institute is 15 years old. We have 17 members of the Virginia General Assembly who have been elected as alumni of Sorensen. They tend to be the younger leaders on both sides of the aisle. And they work together very well across the aisle. There's something that they understand that partisanship is not the highest value of service in Richmond. Younger political leaders have an optimism about making the system work for citizens more than for parties. They've seen partisan gridlock. They know it can hamstring government at any level. Frankly, they have an idealism undiminished by real-world experience of ugliness. They do not discriminate against some people as their elders do. They tend to have respect for both individuals and the systems intended to serve people. Older politicians, like older reporters, often have developed a layer of cynicism, I admit I'm guilty, that colors their outlook and darkens the possibilities they see for the future. Sorensen's political leaders enjoy sharing their special gifts with their communities because community service is what good citizenship is really all about. In short, leaders are doers who have followers. Community service is where President Barack Obama began. Community service is where any leader can start. In America today, there's no better place to start than in community service. If any of you happens to be interested in a Sorensen program, I'd be very interested in talking to you after this program and would love it if people in this room decide to apply and make the cohort of our programs even more well-balanced between the ages of 20 and, say, 70. Make it 80. I agreed with Marvin that I would stop here and engage in a friendly question and answer because I'm much more interested in listening to you than I am to me. So if you all have any questions about Virginia politics today or about the state of journalism and the media today, they're very related. And believe me, state senators and delegates noticed, and they noticed a great deal, that the coverage was lessened this year. They noticed that instead of TV cameras following them around in the halls, there may be one TV camera following them around in the halls, and not always. They noticed that back home in their daily newspapers, instead of thorough reports on what the General Assembly was up to, there were truncated reports, often with an AP bug on the top, instead of a locally written story. This is the trend across the country. There are 10 newspapers in the state, actually there are 10 newspapers in the nation right now that are within months of collapse due to bankruptcy. Some of the major papers in the country, and they would shock you, from the Cleveland Plain Dealer to the Chicago Sun-Times to the Boston Globe, which is owned by the New York Times, which is also in some financial difficulty, to many papers in the greater western part of our country, are within 2 or 3 months of closing their doors, as a paper did just a few weeks ago in Denver after more than a century of service to Colorado. There is not yet developed in our country a working profit model for newspapers to coexist with the internet. The internet has drained the most revenue that newspapers, which are now owned by larger and larger groups and therefore carry more and more debt on their books. Newspapers once had double-digit profit margins built in based on the advertising that they were guaranteed to receive. Well, that advertising has fled, and they haven't changed the business model to support the reporting that has to be done to keep democracy healthy in this country. So if we don't find another business model, and it may be a nonprofit model, we are in for a very rough sled over the next several years in terms of political coverage in our media. The other thing that's happening in our media, and it's something I'd love to engage you in conversation about, it relates to the debate between Republican Party Chairman Rush Limbaugh and Republican Party Chairman Michael Steele. Every part of our media is becoming more biased, almost without exception. And they're doing this because they're following the model of test your audience and find out what they want and go after what they want. And that is why Britney Spears and women with octuplets are more important than national debate. But they are following this poll model, and they are following it into ideological camps in many cases. One thing I enjoyed doing during the presidential race last year was watching MSNBC and watching Fox News, because fair and balanced might have been somewhere in between, but I don't think it was fairly characterized by either outlet. If you listen to the opinion that flows on both, Newspapers and media outlets are becoming more and more party organs, as they were in Jefferson's time. This is nothing new. We're returning to a former model, and it's a model that has its flaws. But I'll open it to Q&A.
Glad to have you here.
Thank you.
Would you make some comments about how the Democratic primary with the three people running for governor is shaping up? How you feel about that?
I think it's shaping up as a very expensive race. In fact, I would bet that people in this room have been getting phone calls. Because, and I've heard complaints from Democrats who have said, I wish they would quit calling me for money. We have an unprecedented fundraiser in this race, Terry McAuliffe, who was a former Democratic National Committee chairman, former chair of Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign last year, and someone with unprecedented fundraising prowess for a state political campaign. Terry entered the race last December, actually technically in January, and has already outraised and is sort of leaving in the dust behind him Cree Deeds and Brian Moran, the other two who are on the June 9th ballot. Cree Deeds and Brian Moran have taken the endorsement route, which is more traditional in Virginia. Both have picked up impressive endorsements, but Terry's picking up some endorsements as well. It is a very difficult race to call because you have two candidates from Northern Virginia, Brian and Terry. You have one candidate from Bath County, which is sort of nowhere in a population center, or nowhere near. Charlottesville is the population center in Cree Deeds district. And if the two candidates from Northern Virginia do as expected, they will do both very well in the urban portions of Virginia, from Loudoun and Fairfax to Norfolk and Virginia Beach. The problem with that for Cree is that he can wipe up in the rest of Virginia, but who votes in a Democratic primary in June? Well, it's not folks out in Scott County or Bath County or Wise County. It's folks in Fairfax County. The local guy, I think, is perceived as the polls have shown him to be in name identification as perhaps being in third place in what could be a very close race. Now, former governor and now former mayor Wilder has predicted that before the June primary, this will sort itself out into a two-way race. He didn't predict who the two would be, with a third sort of trailing. And I think a lot of people see that as a possible model. But in a Democratic primary in June, Democrats are lucky to have between 4% and 9% of the registered voters of the state participate. This somewhat limits Terry McAuliffe's ability to use money because it's very difficult to predict exactly which 5% to 8% of the electorate will be out there trying to touch a screen or whatever they do these days. They had an election yesterday in Fairfax, and they had some voting problems on touchscreen machines. I am very glad that in Charlottesville last year, I was delighted to walk into the polling place, and I went late enough so I didn't have to stand in line, to find the option of voting by paper or voting on an electronic machine, or in this case, the rotodial machine that those of us in the city are used to. We have to do a better job of conducting elections in a way that people feel confident in their outcome. And right now, in states from Ohio to New York to Virginia to Florida, touchscreen voting has had some problems, as it did yesterday. This race for Sharon Bulba's seat on the Fairfax County Board of Supervisors is so close that I don't think people know today who won.
Hi, Bob.
Hi.
A few years ago when I was on a committee, and I was appointed to Bob McDonald was on that committee also. An opportunity just to chat with him one-on-one, very relaxed situation. He said, you know, Bob, if the Republican Party in Virginia had gotten its act together regarding environmental matters, we would have the governorship and the legislature now, and we would keep that for for many years to come. We would be unbeatable. And I thought that was a very interesting comment, and I pretty much agreed with him, especially considering that they did not have that kind of a reputation. And kind of sadly, somewhat later, he represented some folks that certainly did not have very good environmental records. I also, some months later, was talking with Emily Couric about Bob McDonnell and McDonnell and what she thought about his record and his background and such. And she said, Bob, I find him unacceptably rigid. And it seems now that he's gone to a very considerable effort to establish himself as a centrist and get away from the more conservative aspects of his upbringing and career. And my question is, do you see that as I do? That's been very much a purposeful situation regarding the last election, and do you think it'll work?
I think Bob McDonnell is a very savvy political figure. I think he has recognized what portions of his party platforms appeal outside the base and what portions do not. And he has chosen to emphasize those portions of his party's platform that do appeal outside the base, especially to independent voters in Virginia. This is nothing new. This is something that you would expect any smart politician to do with a nomination in hand. He is fortunate to have a nomination in hand. This isn't always true. Look at the Democrats. So he is today, as I wrote in a column last year, I think it still holds the favorite among the four candidates running for governor because he starts with better name recognition than the three Democrats. He starts with the ability to move toward the center by choosing to emphasize those portions of his party's platform that more Virginians tend to agree on and that appeal to independents. And he is not scaring voters the way he would be scaring them if his positions were portrayed by the other side. Eventually, his positions will be portrayed by the other side, and there will be a clash between the Bob McDonnell image that he is presenting and the Bob McDonnell image that the winner of the Democratic Party primary presents. It'll be up to Virginia voters to determine which is the more authentic, and the nastier the job the Democrats do in trying to portray him, the more he will win that comparison. Yes.
Hi, Bob. I'd like to ask about a piece of legislation. I think that for maybe the seventh time this year, Senator Creed Deeds introduced his bipartisan redistricting legislation, and I'd be curious to know what you think about the chances are for that ever getting passed.
Well, there is an election this November, and in that election, 100 members of the House of Delegates will be chosen. It depends on who is elected in the House. The House P&E Committee has been the graveyard for that piece of legislation, which this year escaped the Senate on a unanimous vote. Every Republican of every stripe, knowing it would be killed by their colleagues in the House, voted in favor of a nonpartisan redistricting plan. I think the legislation has promise. What probably has more promise is divided government in terms of actually achieving some sort of compromise or bipartisan redistricting. There are certain political powers that political parties are loath to hand over to anyone. One of them is the redistricting power because it is such power for maintaining incumbency and for maintaining party majorities. And since the software has gotten so much more sophisticated, it is very easy for I guess five of us in this room to sit down with the software for the electoral map of Virginia and to come up with, based on who's been voting in party primaries in recent years, 40 pretty safe Republican seats, 35 pretty safe Democratic seats, and enough that are competitive in the middle but Republican-leaning that they can maintain that majority. And they're not going to give up that majority power willingly. I think it's going to have to be forced at the ballot box, and it depends on who the new House of Delegates will be and who the new governor will be. The new governor, if it's Creed Deeds or if it's Brian Moran, for that matter, will make that a priority to change Virginia's system to make it more in line with the states such as Iowa and New Jersey, which have a true less partisan redistricting. But as far as the current makeup of the House and Senate, we can wait a long time. And we do have divided government, which isn't always a bad thing.
Could you comment on Jeff Frederick?
Jeff Frederick is... I had an interesting conversation about Jeff Frederick with a Republican Party chairman of a county party last weekend. And he said, here we go again. You know, he was elected by those people at a state convention who stayed late enough in the game after the other offices had been, nominations had been decided. In other words, the true believers who had an axe to grind or a cause to promote stayed, while the folks who had been there all morning and into the early afternoon had something better to do with their late afternoons. Had the vote been taken at 10 o'clock in the morning, John Hager would still be the chairman of the Republican Party of Virginia. The vote wasn't taken at 10 o'clock in the morning. It was the last item of business of the day. Jeff is a very divisive figure. He is someone who believes that the Republican Party will only succeed if it is true to every core principle that he sees as its core principle. And that is not the same vision shared by a majority of his party in the General Assembly, but it is shared by enough people in the base of the party, leadership and working active members, that it's a position that many Republicans in Virginia hold to. So there will be a fight early next month. 60-some members of the State Central Committee will probably decide that Jeff Frederick has been in the chair long enough. And because Bob McDonnell, the candidate for governor, wants a new chair, he should be able to have a new chair. This doesn't always work. George Allen, when he was elected governor of Virginia in 1993, tried removal of, that's the last time a state party chair had been under assault, and people in his party had tried to remove him. And George Allen couldn't muster the votes right after a big landslide victory to remove his party chair. So it's not a sure thing, but I tend to think because members of the Virginia Senate and fellow members of the House and district chairs want a new chair, that they'll muster the two-thirds, or I guess it's two-thirds vote they need on the Central Committee to take Jeff back to Prince William.
Were you surprised by the outcome of the November 4th election in 2008? And what do you see about participation levels by groups, demographic groups, that had not participated before?
I was surprised by some of the states that went the way they did. I had a year earlier been arguing with friends I have in the Democratic Party that Barack Obama was going to win the election and that Hillary Clinton didn't stand a chance because she was running the kind of campaign that I've seen run so often in Virginia. I am the presumptive nominee. I have bought up all the consultants. I have all the machinery in my corner. I am the presumptive nominee, and I will win the nomination. Well, that's not a very winning way to attract voters in primaries or especially in mass meetings to come out and spend hours when someone else can be more inspirational. So I wasn't surprised at the result. I was surprised that Indiana and North Carolina went the way they did. I think we have a demographic in this country that is changing, that is allowing more participation by groups that had not been encouraging participation by groups that had not been very active in the political process, and this is a healthy thing. There will be pushback. The Obama administration will not cure the economy in its first 2 years. It seems quite apparent today. And we will see in 2 years what happens to administrations that promise one thing and deliver only part of what they've promised, and that have attention spans of voters about as long as whatever time the last soundbite was on. I think he's in for a very rough time, but I was not surprised at his election. Yes?
You stated about the length of the soundbites on the news. What do you attribute that to?
People's attention spans.
Now, on 29, they regularly had Loretta Benigni, I think that's her.
Yes, she's moved on to Raleigh, North Carolina. She's
right,
a very good reporter.
She gave, you know, very good news reports of what was going on
she
in
did.
Richmond.
She did, and they still have that staffed, and again, I applaud them because they're the only station in Virginia that bothers to cover state government year in and year out, and state the General Assembly when it's in session. You know, to me, as someone who was down there with all these TV stations from across the state, this is shocking. It is just shocking. But, of course, it's happening to newspapers as well. I think the American attention span has shrunk to the extent that they want fast-paced infotainment news rather than slow-paced informational news. And the papers that have the longer stories are the ones that are perhaps having the hardest time making the sale to the public. It is an unfortunate trend in our country today that people over 50 will prefer to have a newspaper in their hands, and people under 30 will prefer to read it only on a computer screen where it doesn't cost them a penny or doesn't necessarily have to. So I think we're just seeing we're seeing changes in the way Americans places where they go for news and the attention spans they devote to news.
And yet the younger people who read a newspaper online. And that doesn't make sense.
I read tons of newspapers online. It is not the same thing as sitting down with one and digesting page after page because, unfortunately, what's happening is Americans are getting into the self-selection of news again. They are deciding, well, I like this headline and this snippet, but I'm not as interested in this thing over here. In a newspaper, at least you have a wider variety of stories and pictures staring you in the face that can attract your interest for more than 6 seconds. When you're online, that isn't necessarily the case. You basically are captivated by the lead or the headline of a story, and you read what appeals to you based on a smaller set of attention to the nature of the story, and you go where you want to go. More people are reading sports, fewer people are reading politics, and that's just the nature of news and the nature of where Americans are looking for their news. Yes?
Would you tell us more about your undergraduate college program in the summer? And so many of the Obama supporters in Virginia were college undergraduates, and they feel sort of at a loss about where to turn now, and that sounds like a wonderful program. And how many do you take every summer?
Every summer we take about 30 college leaders from across Virginia, and we keep them in a UVA dorm 7 days a week for 4 weeks. They get to know each other pretty well. The beauty of the program, as with our other programs, is that roughly half of the participants are Democrats and roughly half of the participants are Republicans. Now, this is fairly apparent by the time they're political leaders in college. In high school, it's not as apparent. And starting this Saturday, we'll start the interview process for the high school leaders program. And it's really more of an ideological breakdown. But it's very important to the program to have people from different sides of the aisle or different sides of different political philosophies engaged in policy discussions and political discussions with each other, because they learn more than what they came into the room with. They learn the other side. They learn more about why they like something based on what someone else is saying as the other position or another position. So it's a valuable program, and we find high school and college leaders who actually are turned on about races that are not presidential races. We're fortunate to have folks who are very savvy at a tender age, and these folks tend to work very hard in campaigns these days. So they come with some political experience behind them, and they love sharing that and sharing their views with people who can believe something completely different from a different part of Virginia. So it's really almost a unique program in the country that way. We have a fourth program, I hadn't mentioned, a candidate training program, which is a four-day program that we now do twice a year. We did it in January at Montpelier, James Madison's lovely estate. And we had 19 candidates. Some are now running for Alexandria City Council. Some are now running in May. Some are now running for sheriff in Danville and Portsmouth. Folks who really brought more to the table than you would expect in novice candidates who had never sought office before, but people who are very interested in working across the aisle with folks on the other side and taking that training. At that program in January, we had two visitors stay with us the 4 days. One was from the University of Texas at Austin, and one from the University of Wisconsin at Madison. So there is interest around the country in emulating these programs and having bipartisan training become more the norm in political training, political leadership training. And that's something that I'm glad that we are able to show people, because it works. Again, the 17 members of the General Assembly who are Sorensen grads maintain a bond and a friendship that allows them to cooperate with each other when other members of their party wouldn't necessarily cross the aisle. These folks know the value of crossing the aisle. I was on the radio Monday afternoon with Jill Vogel, who is a Republican state senator from the northern part of the Shenandoah Valley. She's not a graduate of our program, but she and three other state senators who happened, like her, to be freshmen, formed a bipartisan caucus during the session and enacted some legislative changes. Three of them happen to be members of the Privileges and Elections Committee, so that they can, you know, the committee structure is where the business of the House and Senate is done, and they could actually bring a bipartisan wedge into this committee. And that's what these young folks are learning at the College Leaders Program. They're learning the ability to the power of bipartisanship when it's appropriate. Yes.
Could you share with us any more information that you might have about Rush Limbaugh and Republican leader Steele, and what might be some of the outcomes?
Well, I asked Jill Vogel on the radio in Harrisonburg Monday afternoon whether she thought that Michael Steele or Rush Limbaugh was the chairman of her party. And she said, well, of course it's Michael Steele, and people know that, but... And then she went into a very interesting discussion of how Rush Limbaugh is important to the party, important to the party's base, stirs up the base, keeps it active, involved, talking about issues. And by the time I finished listening to her, I thought the Republican Party might have two chairmen. Rush Limbaugh has been designated the Republican Party chair by the White House, by the way, just because he is so divisive a character that Republicans tend to love him, at least conservative Republicans tend to love him, Democrats tend to hate him, and he is not very popular with the independent vote that counts in the middle. Yes.
I wonder if you are aware of any news organization that has a profitable model economically, and also what trends might be going on in schools of journalism.
Good question. There are models that are profitable. They just aren't profitable to the extent that the industry and its investors were expecting based on past performance. It had been expected that if you owned a newspaper, you would have a daily newspaper, you would have a monopoly in whatever community you were serving, and that you could charge whatever ad rates you wanted to charge in that community. That model has gone out the window, thanks to the internet and thanks to the availability of the multiplicity of news sources. So there are profitable papers still, many of them across the country. They just aren't profitable in the ways that Wall Street has always expected them to be profitable. And to get profitable to that extent, they are jettisoning many of the assets that enable them to cover the news. They are downsizing by throwing, as WCVE, the public station in Richmond, television station, just did, its production staff. They didn't jettison any suits. They jettisoned the folks who put their TV programs on locally. That's the business model these days. You know, you write yourself by jettisoning the folks who you want to jettison without a long-term look at what it does to the ability to cover the news. So I'm not optimistic. I think we have to develop some nonprofit models that will allow people to serve the interests of the community without making a fortune, and yet have a viable, perhaps public radio is probably the closest model right now. It doesn't rely as much on public funding as it does on the wife of the founder of McDonald's and some many hundreds of thousands of private donors who have made it a valuable news source. Yeah.
Bob, I've seldom, if ever, heard the word ethics and politics used in the same sentence. And you did mention the word ethics when you were talking about this.
We do. We teach ethics as well. I don't generally broadcast that because people, you teach ethics? You know.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Do you try to promote ethics at the Sorensen Institute?
Yes.
And if so, are these ethics written?
We have, as part of our programs, participants draw their own ethical plans for campaigns. We have ethicists who come in, generally from out of state. They're more trusted. And they help explain where the dilemmas in ethics lie in the political world of today. And they explain that it's not between good and evil, but it's between good and good, and you've got to make choices and you've got to set lines in advance for determining what your behavior will be given certain contingencies, and lines over which you decide where to place them and you decide you will not cross personally. And it is very heartening to see the ethical campaign plans that are drawn by these candidates. The 19 who went to Montpelier and came out the end of January, some of them have put their ethical campaign plans on their websites, their campaign websites, and they read very, very well, and they are encouraging to people to let them know that they will and won't do certain things as far as accepting contributions, and they will and won't do certain things as far as what they say about their political opponents. And the characterizations they will make of their political opponents. And of course, these get tested in the last week of a campaign because they all have consultants, and the consultants say, if you do this, you will win. And the candidate who's been through an ethical campaign training program will say, yes, and I have to live in this community after this campaign is over. You don't. The number of applicants we have
gotten. Applicants, as far as the ratio of young men to young women.
That's an interesting point. It's about 24 to 16 men to women, which is about as good as we've gotten. Emily Kirk was in our first class, but she was in a class that was much more all male, much more male. And gradually, over time, women have been increasing their application numbers and acceptance rates into these programs, so that it's close to a 55-45, sometimes a 60-40 split, which is somewhat better than the state's pool. Virginia lags far behind other states in terms of its participation of women in elected office. We're in the bottom third of the states when it comes to electing women, and I'm not sure why that is. I guess there's something about tradition here.
Seems to me there's a problem in our politics with too much corporate money. Now, I can see that politics should represent the economy of a country as well as the opinions of individual citizens, and so I can see there's a case for corporate money at some level, but it seems to me there's too much. Here in the state, I see a pervasive influence of Dominion Power, for example. In fact, I commonly hear that they've bought the legislature and get what they want.
They're well represented.
Usually
for rent, not for purchase.
Yes. And I'm curious about your comments on that, and it's obviously closely related to this question about ethics.
It is difficult to change the system. with the Supreme Court saying that free speech is free speech, and that includes free corporate business speech and speech by groups of individuals regardless of their nature. This gives us the trend that we have seen increasingly of rich and richer candidates, because the antidote to business having an inordinate influence is often an individual of great wealth. And that has its own set of problems in terms of how close to the common man those candidates can be. We are not at a place where we're about to change that system. The court has ruled quite strongly that free speech is what governs the ability to give money. You can ban certain categories of money, but you can't ban others. And as long as every corporation and every individual has free speech, in Virginia, they have unlimited free speech. Yes, Francis.
Bob, you're doing a great job where you are. I wish you could also do the newspaper at the same time like you used to do.
Thank you.
Have you had any comments about the lieutenant governor's race? There is a fairly strong woman running in that race.
It's a very lively race. Virginians on June the 9th, if they show up in a polling place, we'll see four. There used to be five, but one of them dropped out last week. Candidates for lieutenant governor, which is a bit unusual, running around the state trying to get known. The best known of them, I guess, is Jody Wagner, who served in the cabinet of Governor Mark Warner and was treasurer and finance secretary under Tim Kaine until she resigned in August to run for lieutenant governor. But there are three other individuals. There's a gentleman who's on the Russell County Board of Supervisors. There's a woman who's on the Virginia Beach School Board. And there's a UVA law graduate, Michael Signer, who will be at a book festival event that I'm moderating next Thursday, if you all want to come see the other candidate, Michael Signer, who's a former UVA law grad, who is a UVA law grad, has written a book about demagogues in politics. It's a very interesting book. He'll be at the Special Collections Library 2 o'clock next Thursday afternoon for a panel at the book festival. It's very hard to predict a four-way race. There has been some polling that's been done, and Jody Wagner is by far the best-known name of the four, John Bauerbank being in third place, Pat Edmondson, the other woman in the race, who's, like Jody Wagner, a Sorensen alumna. So we actually have three Sorensens who are running statewide this year. Jody, who is perhaps the lead candidate, it's hard to tell, in a four-way race for lieutenant governor in the June 9 primary. Pat Edmondson, who's on the Virginia Beach School Board, and Steve Shannon, who is the only Democrat seeking the nomination for attorney general. He's a delegate from Fairfax County. So there's a chance that Sorensen, which has never had a statewide candidate elected to anything, may have one elected this year. We just had, in fact, it's tomorrow afternoon, no, Friday afternoon, we will have our first investiture of our first Sorensen judge, graduate of one of our programs, is being elevated to the bench over in Augusta County. So some of us may cross the mountain to see a Sorensen grad don some black robes. But the race for lieutenant governor is among people who aren't very well known. They have been making the rounds to speak to every group of three or four or more they can get around and speak to. There will be a debate at the University of Virginia the last Sunday of this month and involving all four of them. It will be at 10:30 a.m. on a Sunday in the building that used to be the law school and is now the environmental science school, Clark Hall.
I have a question over here. First of all, I congratulate. It's good to see somebody articulate the difference between alumnus, alumni, and alumni. There's an obvious need for bipartisanship in this day and time. How do you see that shaping up in the Virginia groups, and how can we influence, and what can Virginia do to get the national group to be less of this bipartisanship and into more bipartisanship conversations?
Well, I think what's happened in Virginia is that we have more and more adopted the national model. And the national model is rule or ruin, majority rules. And by the way, if you don't have 60 votes in the Senate, you aren't ruling nothing. So that has sort of moved 100 miles south down to Richmond and more affected the legislative sessions that have occurred over the last 8 years. So that we're lucky this year, it being an election year, that we do not have a special session. We don't have to sit around and watch the legislature get together later in the summer and do nothing, which it's been doing like 5 of the last 9 years when it comes to special sessions. What can we do? My faith is in the new participants in the process, because they are demanding something better. There are a lot of us over the age of 50 who are used to partisanship being a sharp-elbowed game, and we cover it as a sharp-elbowed game, and it becomes partisan when there's no need for it to be partisan. It becomes partisan just to put people on the other side on the board so that 2 years from now you can make a campaign commercial against them. It's that kind of partisan. And I see people in the leadership willing to play that game, and I see people who are younger and less enamored of it, and I think there is a resistance among younger participants in the process to that sort of super partisanship. There's plenty of time for partisanship in politics. It doesn't have to be any more than 20% of the time. Yes,
Bob, I was have followed the issue of transportation in the paper carefully the last 10 or 15 years.
You've and, noticed a lot that's happened on our roads since then, too.
Yeah, a lot of speeding and a lot of congestion and a lot of thoughtlessness, but and some danger from my perspective. But I recall that during Governor Warner's tenure and now Governor Kane's, that there was a lot of frustration on both their parts and other people, that they were not able to get transportation initiatives through, and that they were stymied by the more conservative members of the legislature. And you mentioned a while ago that you thought there were very few contests that this coming fall are going to be really tough for the incumbents. And in spite of what I perceive as widespread unhappiness with the transportation system, would you comment on that, please?
When you draw your own district, you can draw it to include the voters closest to you and the voters you like the most. And we've seen so much of that that we have a system in which paralysis can be the norm because there are 70 safe seats out of 100, roughly. There are only 30 that can be usually seriously contested. That, by the way, is a better percentage than in the Congress year after 2 years. Because so many states have adopted the hard partisanship redistricting model that, or the incumbent protection model. You don't have to have one party in control to have incumbent protection. You just let everybody draw their own lines, and they're quite safe for a while. In fact, the problem with Democrats in Richmond when they lost control of the House and the Senate in the late 1990s was that both parties in the General Assembly, both the Democratic Party in the House and the Senate, had become largely incumbent protection societies. They didn't have a bench. They weren't out developing a bench. They were developing safe seats and protecting those seats and putting all their money into reelecting themselves into those safe seats. And as a result, they lost their majority while the other party was hungrier and was coming up with many more candidates with new ideas. Transportation is something that unfortunately requires a lot of money and a lot of planning time. And Virginia right now doesn't have a lot of money. We have enough time to plan. So you see highway projects sitting on the books for 20, 30 years without the funding to complete them, such that we had the rather strange situation this week of 7 chambers of commerce up and down US 29 saying, build the bypass. Well, what they want is a bypass that planning and time has made less useful to anyone to build, because it would rush people 6 miles to a series of traffic lights starting at Forest Lakes and continuing into Madison County with no bypass to relieve that pressure. That's why some communities in Virginia have double bypasses, like Warrenton. You can go around Warrenton either way now. But we have a system that allows paralysis both in the legislature and on the highways, because it's difficult to choose the revenue sources needed to maintain the roads that the state says we need. Yes.
The Washingtonian magazine had an interesting article calling for Northern Virginia to be the 51st state. Do you think that the unoccupied portion of Virginia will ever be able to vote and give that to somebody, give it to the United States, and let us get off the hook for that?
The problem is the definition of Northern Virginia keeps changing. And as of today, we are in it. It crossed the Occoquan a long time ago, and it's crossed the Rappahannock, and we're about sitting in it. So Northern Virginia's problems are our problems. Our problems are Northern Virginia's problems. We are co-dependent, co-enablers of paralysis. Yes?
I read in Business Week that Arlington is supposed to be the best county in the U.S. as far as riding out the recession or depression or whatever you call it. Did you see that?
I didn't see that, but I do believe it. And as an Arlingtonian, I'm quite proud. Native Arlingtonian. Arlington has a special economy because it is the bedroom of the capital, and it has sunk under the weight of defense spending, both for real military and consultant military and now IT military. And Arlington is sitting pretty when it comes to federal largesse that were Senator John Warner still in the Congress, we would see coming to many more traditional military siphoning points in Virginia over the next several years that we will be sorely missing his votes, I predict. Yes. And Arlington is being well run. Arlington is a community where the political discourse tends to be civil. There tends to be more participation by younger voters. It is a good model. It resembles it used to resemble even more the nonpartisan model of local politics, because so many of its workers were hatched that there were shadow parties for ABC, Arlingtonians for Better County, AIM, conducted proxy elections for the Democrats and the Republicans almost. But those shadow parties have sort of merged into their main parties, and it's still a very participatory democracy up there. Many more people participate in mass meetings and in public forums than in many places in Virginia. So it's still a good place to weather a recession or whatever we're in.
Going back to 29, what about a high-speed railroad right down the center?
Well, there is stimulus money available for some strange things, but usually they have to be shovel-ready.
But I was thinking about the new transit system in the county and the city. And what do you think? Do you think that Albemarle County, the way it's laid out, that a public transit system can actually work here? I mean, it would be really nice if we could have more sidewalks and pedestrian walks. And now you can't, even if you take a bus, you can't cross the street. There's no pedestrian cross.
Or yeah, I'll try to cross 29
on foot.
But
the way it's so spread out now, I just wonder about that.
It was not planned for mass transit. It was planned for the automobile and everybody driving home to the county and driving up their cul-de-sac and finding their own driveway. And that model has been slow to change, but is changing. And there are planners in Albemarle who are interested in looking at new models for transportation.
I am very encouraged looking at Norfolk and Virginia Beach by the rapid rail development that is finally taking place with some political accord down there. There had been a resistance in Virginia Beach to seeing the full extension of light rail, but now it appears there will be a station where 64 and 264 split outside downtown Roanoke, and it will follow 264 into downtown, and then we'll circle around to ODU and then back to its original point, and it will extend east to the beach, eventually to the Virginia Beach Convention Center and the oceanfront, and that will be a very exciting opportunity for people to get out of their cars and enjoy some better transportation in that urban center. Albemarle hasn't progressed to that extent that the planners have really the mass to do that yet. But I think there is interest in rail in places where there had not been interest in rail before. So I think rail is definitely going to be part of what keeps Virginians from wasting too much of their days on the highway.
I forget which politician said that, one of our Virginian politicians. But do you believe that the politics of old Virginia is dead?
That was Tim Kaine. And Tim Kaine said that right after Barack Obama won a rather sizable vote in Virginia. And, you know, I do a public radio show once a month, and about every second or third month, the governor, whoever he is, comes on the show. And Tim Kaine was asked that very question by a Charlottesville resident last time I had him on last month. She said, "I love you, I love your wife, but what do you mean saying, oh, Virginia is dead? You were talking about my heritage and the heritage of my family, and I will never vote for you again." And he said, "Well, you're not going to have the opportunity." But he also said that what he meant by that remark was that the old Virginia that reflects the state song that has been retired and not brought back is dead. And I very much agree that era of politics has waned, and we are in a new era of politics in Virginia that makes Virginia much more a mid-Atlantic state than a traditional southern state, where old Virginia would have been a song that they would sing on the way to the polls.
None of us has brought up the issue of the aging tsunami. And I'm curious to know whether you think the graying of Virginia, in fact, the graying of our country, but the graying of Virginia in particular, will have any significant impact on the political scene.
Oh, I do. Virginia is one of those states, and there are many states in this category, that is getting older. And older Virginians tend to be voters, and they tend to be politically more involved and aware and astute than younger Virginians, despite the last year's experience. So I think you will continue to see a beautiful demand on services from an increasing number of graying voters who will demand what they think government should do for them. And that is not going to be an easy thing for the state, which is not getting lots of new revenue sources. The choice of how much taxes to raise and how for what services. Right now, the health services that are shared with the federal government are the most expensive and fastly increasing services that our state provides. So I think you'll see an emphasis of perhaps less of the education dollar coming out of the General Assembly, not less in real terms, but less in percentage terms, and more in health care and related demands for service by those of us who tend to vote because we're older and we know more than them young folks. Ann Holton, the governor's wife, her father addressed our class last weekend in Yorktown and gave a fascinating political history of Virginia based on his post-World War II attempt to make it a two-party competitive state and to unseat the Byrd machine, which he eventually did in 1969. I've detected no such interest on Ann's part, however. I think we will continue to produce a surplus of former governors in Virginia.
Thank you.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Daniels.